So we have insects. I think that's what people are most often familiar with, the bees and the butterflies. And but there's also a lot of other insects that can be pollinators, like beetles and flies. And then, of course, we have other animal pollinators like our birds. What's our big bird pollinator here in Ohio?
Hummingbird.
Hummingbird, exactly.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to Our Rich Land, a podcast of Richland Soil and Water Conservation District and Kingwood Center Gardens, bringing you stories and insight on conservation in our small corner of Ohio.
Thanks for joining us on our quest.
Oh, yeah. And I'm Josh Steffen. I'm the executive director here at Kingwood Center Gardens.
And I am Evan Stern, a district technician for Soil and Water. Welcome. Hello, hello, hello.
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 You are listening to Our Rich Land. This is episode number 8, Giving Pollinators the Right of Way, part 1. With Marnie Tichnell from OSU Extension. Thanks for being here. Marnie is who you heard at the beginning of the episode in our little section there. Thanks for listening, and let's jump right in. In this episode, we welcome Marnie Tichnell, Wildlife Program Specialist for the Ohio State University School of Environment and Natural Resources. Marnie has a bachelor's and master's in natural resources from OSU, has worked for both the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as well as the U.S. Forest Service, and she attributes her love of nature to spending time outdoors during childhood family vacations. And she realized she loved teaching people about it after a stint as a naturalist for Columbus Metro Parks.
Marnie's current role gives her the ability to combine these passions in a variety of ways, from leading workshops to collaborating on New York Times article. On a New York Times article. That sounds interesting. They approach you?
They did.
How did they hear? What did you write about her? What do you?
It was about deer conflict in the garden. So.
Deer conflict.
Like
when they're hungry deer. Season and they're just like.
No. Like human and deer coming together.
We don't know anything about that.
No,
here.
I'm sure you don't at all. We never deal with deer here.
We officially on the record, we love deer and we invite them into our garden all the time. Her specific line of study in recent years has dealt with creating pollinator habitat, a project she has undertaken as the chair of the Right of Way Committee at OSU Mansfield. Ooh, we'll have to dig into that just a little bit more.
Oh, we will.
Well, welcome, Marnie. Thanks for being on our podcast.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Yeah. Just digging around real quick.
Come on.
Shuffle.
I'll start off with questions. Your crazy fact about you first, that you've handled more bats than any other wild animal in your life.
Yeah, that's always a tough question to answer. I'm like, I can't think of anything crazy about myself.
I was going to say, handling bats?
It's not crazy for me, but maybe it's crazy. Yeah, so I guess going back to some of my roots, I was a grad student at OSU and I studied forest.
On the main campus?
Wildlife, on main campus, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so that's kind of my base, has been my base, still is my base. But I studied bats in forest ecosystems right here in Ohio, in southern Ohio. So
what species?
Many different species. So my task was to determine how bat populations responded to harvests that were taking place to regenerate oaks. Okay. And so I went into these areas of some of our state forests that had been harvested and monitored the bat populations. So you can do that acoustically by listening to their echolocation calls. But then the other way that you do that is by actually capturing bats by using mist nets. And mist nets.
Google it while we're talking.
Yeah. So they're also used to catch birds.
Right.
But they're just these very finely constructed nets. You really cannot see them from far away, hence the name. And what you're basically doing is trying to trap bats to fly into them. Because as we know, bats have echolocation. They can detect something as fine as a single human hair.
Echolocation. What the heck is echolocation? Josh, do you know?
Well, Evan, it's when I go ask for where my children are, and they go, here I am, and I'm like, there you are. Marco.
Polo.
Exactly. It's kind of like that. It's, you know, animals such as a bat, shall we say, plays Marco Polo every night with all the various juicy, crunchy insects that they like to eat, relying on that sound, you know, sophisticated ability to send off high pitch, high frequency sound waves and have them bounce back and locate and pinpoint accuracy on the fly, by the way. No pun intended. Aha!
So you place these nets kind of over corridors and ponds.
Go high up.
So you want to go from the floor all the way up to the tree canopy, if you can. Because if you don't, they're going to find that little space and squeak through it. So once you capture them, you get them out of the net and collect data on them.
So how high up were you guys going with these nets?
Well, we were in, you know, forests, and we were usually netting over like old timber harvest roads.
Okay.
So anywhere from like 15 to 20 feet.
Okay.
Yep, up to the canopy. And then, of course, if we strung the nets over a pond, we might only do like a 6 to 9 foot tall net and catch the bats as they're dipping down to get a drink of water.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't know if you said, do you use the echolocation to lure them in?
No. Okay. So echolocation, that's another way you can monitor bats. You can record their echolocation calls. And then by essentially counting them, you can get an idea
down,
of activity.
Down.
Yeah. Well, like the idea of the activity in the area. If you have a lot of echolocation calls, then that tells you that there's a lot of bats flying around. And then there's kind of that assumption of, well, there's something about this forested habitat that is attractive to them.
Gotcha. So like my daughter picked up a bat.
Ooh.
Yeah, that was flopping on the ground.
Ooh.
Twitching.
Ooh, not good.
Yeah, I wish I had. And she loves pets, not bats anymore, thankfully. But it was. We've been trying to help her with these.
Oh, bless
loving
her
all animals. So she of course.
Well,
had to
my daughter almost pet a bee the other day, so I'm with you. Yeah. You know, you try to teach them like love for
love,
wild animals.
Love from afar.
Yeah, you got to be safe with wild animals. So yeah, no, I mean. Yeah, you definitely never want to pick up a bat, period, and
gloves,
definitely not a bat on the ground. Yeah, if a bat's on the ground, then that's already kind of a red flag that something may not be right.
Yeah.
That could be fine. You know, bats don't move very quickly on the ground, and sometimes they...
In the middle of the day, twitching?
Not a good sign, yeah. So gloves, yes. Thick gloves. And if you really think that bat is injured, that might be when you call a wildlife rehabilitator to help you. If the bat appears fine, then you can pick it up and place it on a tree.
Did we talk about the findings from your bat study?
No, we can. Basically, bats are morphologically different. No surprise there. They like to fly and forage in different areas, depending on their abilities. And some species of bats really appreciated the open canopies that were created from the timber harvests. It's a little bit easier for them to fly faster, find the food that they want to eat, the insects that they're eating.
Morphology. What the heck is that?
Well, it's a combination of two words, more and phology. No. Morphology is the study of the shape of something.
And so Marnie is talking specifically here about bat morphology and how that affects their habits and pollination stuff. So what would bat morphology look like?
Well, they'd have two wings, a head, and ears. I am not a bat expert in terms of, but I would imagine their morphology is going again. It's not just the shape of something, but the study of the shape and then how that affects as an adaptation for a particular environmental response. Yeah. You know, maybe they have slightly bigger ears because they or bigger, longer, shorter wings because they need to fly a longer distance or they need to be able to turn quicker. Mm-hmm. You know, a fruit bat may have longer wings because again, they're not having to dive and spin and, you know, go after, you know, flying insects. Their food source is a stationary, you know, fruit on a tree, you know. Bats that are more of have a little bit more of a migratory pattern. Like there's some in Africa that do massive migration. They're bigger and they have longer wings for, you know, so they don't tire as easily.
Yeah.
I don't really know, but that sounded really good.
No, that sounds good enough.
Well, you'll have to ask Marnie.
So I found certain bat species really responded favorably to those harvests.
Would it, I'm just making an educated guess that bat populations that are already, well, shall we say, well-represented only benefit even more from the open canopy since, you know, especially those that are more used to urban type settings where you're even more open.
Some of those same species that we do see in our urban areas, like big brown bats and red bats, that are able to utilize in more open areas. Yes, okay. They also like those more open canopies.
So as usual, the specialists suffer the more?
Not necessarily. I'll say that since my research, which was many, many years ago, there has been more research out that has found different bat species, some species that are known to forage in more dense areas, mm-hmm. also use like the edges of these harvests. Yeah. So I would say, you know, harvests in general, when it comes to bats, is a win-win. Bats generally like a diversity on the landscape of harvested areas, of forested areas, of open areas.
Is that because also the diversity of type of insects that are...
Yeah, so just like they have morphological differences, those also relate to the insects that they eat and where they find them.
Okay. Wow, that's cool.
Yeah. Bats are cool.
They are very cool.
But so are pollinators.
Yes, pollinators.
Well, bats are pollinators.
And bats are pollinators. There's our connection.
Hello, everybody. Please join us or we will assimilate you. Give us money and your time, talented treasure.
Hello, everyone. If you enjoy our Rich Land, the podcast, and want to support us and the work that we do, the best way to support us is through sharing this podcast with someone like a friend or an enemy, depending on your state of mind. Like and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Like and follow our organizations on all the various social media platforms that we are that have available, and tune in to the daily ebbs and flows of our organizations through our websites, which you can find linked down in the show notes.
Both of our organizations thrive off of the support that we get from the community, and I say that with all honesty. We appreciate our volunteers and the people who donate and our regular attendees, members, and the like. I kind of wanted to start on the ground level before we got into more complex ideas.
Sure.
So, the five.
What is pollination?
Well, the what is?
I mean, that might be even more what is pollination technically?
What are pollinators? Yeah, yeah. So, pollination is simply when pollen is moved, right? So sometimes that pollen is moved within the flower or from flower to flower, and it's what helps plants reproduce, right? The pollen from the male anther is moving to the female reproductive parts, the stigma. Right. Mm-hmm. And a pollinator is then an animal that moves that pollen. And we have lots of different animal pollinators, right?
Or even more general, it's the cause, because of course there's lots of non-animal, even non-biotic living forms like water and wind. Okay.
And wind, right. Yeah. Great point.
Those two. There's lots of forms, like two of them.
Lots of ways that plants pollinate themselves, not just with animal pollinators. Yep. Right. Right. Yeah,
but we're not interested in those. We're interested
talking about the animal pollinators. So we have insects. I think that's what people are most often familiar with, the bees and the butterflies. And but there's also a lot of other insects that can be pollinators, like beetles and flies. And then, of course, we have other animal pollinators like our birds. What's our big bird pollinator here in Ohio?
Hummingbird.
Exactly. Yep. And then we have other animals like we talked about, like bats. But we don't have any bat pollinators here in Ohio. Unfortunately, that would be cool.
More tropical.
Much more tropical. But we do have a few species here in the U.S., but you have to go down to like Texas and Arizona and New Mexico to see those.
Which are
down,
very tropical.
Texas, not really tropical Texas. Yeah.
Getting close.
Yeah, but down there, it's like they sometimes have bats coming to their hummingbird feeders, which would be really cool to
see. That would be fun.
Yeah. Now, here in Ohio, all of our bats eat insects.
Okay.
But and also here in Ohio, I would say our biggest pollinators, or at least the ones that do a lot of the work, are the bees. Okay. Those are our big ones. But again, lots of other animal pollinators as well.
Is it accurate though? I mean, beetles are kind of the largest group of insects. Are they also the largest group of pollinators in general and across the world? Do you know?
I don't know. I know that bees do the most work. They're responsible for most of that animal plant pollination. Some beetles do, but I don't know like how many within that. Was it Coleoptera? I don't know what the order of beetles is.
Because bees are responsible for the majority of, and this we'll get to later in the food system question, food system pollination. But in terms of overall plant pollination, I believe, and I'm sure I'll get fact-checked by Evan when he actually goes to Google this in the post-edit production notes. Beetles are the group, and this is why I like to talk about it, because it's not what people think about.
Yeah,
that beetles are kind of the main care. You know, they do the bulk of the work for most plants.
Cool.
So, real quick, Josh asked me to fact check this in post.
I didn't actually, but he's. But
you did.
I did.
You did in the episode. You were like, Evan's going to fact check this later.
So beetles are.
They are, in fact.
They are, in fact. Not in falsehood, but in fact.
In fact.
The largest group of pollinating organisms on planet Earth.
That is coming from a source I found at the University
and
of Maryland.
Me. I'm not the source.
You're not the source.
Yeah.
I had to check you with a university, a whole entire university.
That is always a good idea. Check those extension websites.
Yeah. So according to the University of Maryland, there are 350,000 flowering plant species, which is crazy. Nearly 90% of them, which I don't know what number that would end up being, 90% of them are visited by beetles. According to the Xerxes Society of Invertebrate Conservation, beetles are among the most diverse group of organisms in existence. One of every four organisms is a beetle. They are among the oldest pollinating organisms, along with flies.
Aha!
One of my favorites when I was in the Amazon. And there was a large water pollinator, which is, we'll say, an oversized version on steroids of a water lily. So that flower, think of a water lily flower, it opens in the morning, and during the day, it attracts in beetles, closes up at night, the beetles have a big, great time, then it opens back up the next morning, and they're free to, so that's their main pollinators,
that's awesome.
Beetles.
Cool.
So.
I think when most people think pollination, like they typically think flower, like flowers comes right to mind. So for someone who doesn't maybe know as much about pollination, what are some more things that we rely upon pollinators for? So not just the reproduction of flowers.
Yeah, well,
plants.
So I think, yeah, you're right there, but let's take it like a step further. You think of the flower, well, what comes next? You know, like what if a bee pollinates a tomato flower? You know, what are you going to get? You're going to get that food. So thinking what comes next after that flower. And you know, then we can talk about how important bees are when it comes to our food supply. So one of those catchy statistics is, I think it's like one in every three bites of food we take can be traced back to animal pollinators. Right.
And specifically, it's European bees.
A lot of it's European bees.
Right. So that's part of what helping people realize the challenge is we've taken food systems that were European and Asian in their origin over millennia. You know, farmers developed these things. Then we transport it across to another continent where that same food system, different in the habitat. And then we expect that to work. Well, why are the European bees struggling? They're for a lot of different reasons. But we also have to keep bringing in these other foreign foodstuffs, right? And so you're creating a food system with surrounding habitat that's foreign. And so a lot of our invasive species issues and the issues go back to design.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the fact that, so that's why we're now interested in native bees all of a sudden and their preservation, because it's a threat to our food supply.
Right. Right.
Because we've created these systems that are dependent upon a foreign source.
Right.
So,
But we do know that some of our native bees are good pollinators.
Right.
So, you know, our bumblebees do a lot of our berry pollination. What is it? The mason bees that are primary for almonds and things like that. So, yeah, you're right.
And we're learning more about that. And they're starting to do the research. I've seen research done on blueberry production in Michigan. I'm a Michigan State grad. So the research that was coming out of there on blueberry fields and native bee populations, that's fairly recent work. So they're learning at it. It's the volume, though, that's the challenge of a lot of our native bees are solitary rather than colonial and social.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's the mass, it's the system that we're used to based on this type of behavior that is natural to that insect.
Right.
And now we have to think of a different way of manufacturing food potentially.
So could you talk a little bit about your work research at OSU Mansfield and what's the official name of the pollinator habitat? Is it a byway or stopover or?
So you can say it's the monarch right of way.
Okay.
The monarch right of way plots or the monarch right of way committee is what I chair.
Okay.
So that committee is a partnership between the OSU Mansfield campus, between First Energy, and other partners. OSU Main Campus Extension and things like that. So. The kind of goal of this partnership or this committee is, you know, this idea of working lands, right?
So what's working lands? What do you mean?
Yeah. So First Energy wants to maintain their right of ways to provide safe and reliable energy, right? But at the same time, wouldn't it be great if they could also provide other benefits like pollinator habitat at the same time, right? So one example of pollinator habitat, and we can talk about this later. There's lots of different types of pollinator habitat, but one is, I think what a lot of people think of is that sunlit field of blooming flowers, often native perennials that keep coming up year after year, right?
So grassland meadow.
Yeah, grassland meadow prairie type habitat. So they're going to be providing the nectar and the pollen for the pollinators, some of which, you know, really need help, like the monarch butterfly, hence the name of our monarch right-of-way committee. Mm-hmm. But really, we're providing for all pollinators. But that type of habitat, not only is it good for the pollinators, but it looks pretty. And rarely do those plants grow tall enough that they're going to get in the way of electrical lines. And a lot of times, once those plants are established, there are less issues with competing plants. There's still management needed, but less. So it's kind of a win-win for First Energy. They're providing that electricity, but at the same time, we're able to provide benefits. And that's just one example of that working lands kind of idea. So going back to the OSU Mansfield campus, First Energy has their right of way going directly through campus. So we're working with them to create some of these habitats. And we have placed several very small pollinator plots of native perennial wildflowers in the middle of campus. And that's just so people can see them and the community can kind of learn about how to establish pollinator habitat, why it's important, why it's there, and that connection between those working lands or with those working lands.
Kind of as another, challenge, and I became aware of this, that I used to, my grad school work was out in Delaware, and the Delaware Center for Horticulture had worked with the state to develop best practices and guidelines for the DOT for median right-of-ways.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I see it now as I commute from Worcester here every day. And, you know, the standard practice, of course, is just mow. And the opportunity that's lost both from a PR standpoint and again, these we'll say public lands, public green space that could be better utilized.
Yeah.
But are we coming in from just we're in farming land farming communities, our approach to everything has always been mow the ditch, so I don't know if that mindset transfers over.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, and that's one component I didn't mention is, yeah, if you get these native perennials established, it means way less mowing, you're saving money, you're saving time and effort. So yeah, that's definitely
The challenge is the perception change, right? They're mowing it. Why? Because they want to, I'm believing it's visibility and safety.
Yep. Yep.
So they had to wrestle through all of those things and the education and so forth. So if you guys get to that point, that might be a good resource to go look at, because they've really have had a lot of good success. It's a small state, so it's a lot easier to concentrate your resources, but they've really been able to work with the state and really developing good stuff.
Yeah, that's fantastic, because you're right. There's that stigma of it's weedy, it looks bad. And that's what a lot of folks need to understand, is a lot of those native perennials need a couple years at least to establish. So in the meantime, it's not going to look great. You just got to be patient. And our plots at the OSU Mansfield campus, they looked not so great over the first couple of years, but you know, we just tried to get out there and share that with folks and educate, and now they look pretty nice. So
I know along interstates in Ohio, there's usually a sign, like
Ohio
a white sign.
Ohio Pollinator Habitat Initiative. Yeah. So that's an initiative. They've definitely, it's composed of multiple partners, but they're working with ODOT, Ohio Department of Transportation, to do much like what you were talking about in Delaware. And we're starting to see that more as we drive throughout the state. And it's the same idea as, you know, these working lands and also less mowing and maintenance and things like that, and putting habitat out there for species that need it.
Our Rich Land is a production of Richland Soil and Water Conservation District and Kingwood Center Gardens. Richland SWCD is a government agency with a mission to assist the citizens of Richland County to protect and improve the county's natural resources by providing exceptional educational, planning, and technical assistance. We provide an abundance of services and opportunities, including but not limited to stormwater management and permitting, agricultural outreach and technical assistance, fun workshops and events, soil testing, fish, tree seedling, and native plant sales, and a boatload more.
Yeah, and Kingwood Center Gardens was the vision of Charles Kelly King. He opened a garden for the citizens of Richland County and beyond. We are there to build deep connections to natural world and to each other so that human and natural communities can thrive. We do this through really providing magical experiences within an historic garden estate. We do it through educational programmings, stunning, beautiful horticultural displays of annuals, perennials, and trees and shrubs. Great educational programming and interpretation. We're passionate about people, place, plants, and presentation. And we do that on a daily basis and through our seasonal events and shows that we provide.
I guess, what are the different pollinator habitats other than like the meadow?
Yeah. And I think that's what a lot of people think about, you know, when they think about pollinators, is that open sunny space with lots of flowers. And that's right. I mean, that's accurate. That's, as long as it's diverse. A lot of those plants are native, and we can have that native discussion here in a little bit. But you know, that's going to provide the pollen and the nectar resources for pollinators, but that's not the only habitat out there. Right. We started the conversation about bats and forests, and that's kind of my roots. And so I love to share with people that forests or wooded areas or our native trees and shrubs can also be great pollinator habitat as well. And that's not often what we think about when we think about pollinator habitat. We don't really look at the forest and think, oh, bees and butterflies, but
that was kind of where I was going with one of those prep questions. Was I wanted to, like, I don't think about, I'm aware of some association, plant, you know, insect associations like wild ginger, for example, understory, ground cover, pollinated by ants.
Yeah.
Are there a lot of bee type pollination mating systems within a forest environment that you're aware of?
Yeah. So, you know, let's say like our mining bees, some of our solitary ground nesting bees. A lot of times they're the ones that are going after those early blooming woody plants, like, you know, cherries and things like that. So there are definitely associations. And you know, to that note, that is why some of our native trees and shrubs are really important, because they're blooming and they're providing those pollen and nectar sources before some of our native wildflowers are not even thinking about blooming, right? So that's why those plants are so important. And again, a lot of times folks don't make that connection of, oh yeah, these woody plants are really important to pollinators. So, you know, maples would be another great example. Really early blooming, great nectar, early season nectar for some of our bees that are out in the spring, especially our solid, or some of our native bees that start that breeding cycle early. So really important connection there. And then, you know, getting a little bit away from bees, if we start looking at, you know, our lepidopterans or butterflies and moths, we can talk about host plants, which are the plants that the females, butterflies and moths, lay their eggs on. And a lot of times, many of our species here in Ohio are looking for woody plants as host plants. And what better place to find a diversity of host plants than in a forest, as long as it's diverse.
Just did a quick Google search here, and it made me aware of one that I totally forgot about. Black locust, which is a very common one here. Very much strong. It's one of the strong bee sources during, you know, early June.
Yeah, big bee tree.
Bee tree.
Maples for sure, black tupelo, or what's some call it around here? Sweetwood, sourwood,
black gum,
sweet gum.
Oh, sweet gum.
So there's even ash, I believe, are bee pollen, and that's one of the things that's contributed to colony collapse disorder, they think, has been so ashes are. And other things in the pot, they're getting the neonics, the systemic, you know, insecticides that are going up in there to try to stop emerald ash borer. And then because it persists in the pollen for so long, the bees come along, gather it, and then I take it back, and there goes the hive. So that's one of the challenges also, that, again, we're trying to use one solution to solve a singular problem that has far more ranging effects that may have worse problems. I have a feeling I'm going to predict 50 years from now, ashes are going to be just fine. They, at least because of their ability to seed and germinate, their ability to come back and repopulate after, the grazer has come through.
Right.
Is not all species, but it will be pretty decent, I think. And then some balance will kind of find its way in there. But not all trees are as successful as ashes are, unfortunately. So anyway, that was another.
Nature's pretty tough.
Yeah. Well, that's
it does, and it always surprises us. So
that's part of the whole invasive native issue, is we have looked at our habitats as fragile, and we've got to preserve them, because especially in some kind of climate or a climax state that doesn't exist. It's always evolving.
It's always changing.
And so we suffer as a species in the transition and the chaos that's with all these introduced species and the recombination that's going to occur, that will take a very long time to establish. And it just sucks for us. And so we're responding.
We're impatient.
So a lot of the conservation focus is actually because it's short-sighted. We have such a little time frame of data that we are working with. That maybe invasives are not as bad as we think they are, right? And that it's a controversial statement to say.
It is.
Because we have blinders on because of our, again, science has only been being practiced and there's data recorded for only so long. Everything else is assumption if you go start extrapolating back or forward. So we're learning more and more.
Is the point. Yeah, I would agree with that.
And so a degree of caution and humility in terms of pronouncing, you know, this plant is bad.
Some, I would say, from what we know,
right,
based from my perspective and their impacts on wildlife, yeah, they're bad. But there is a huge gray area. There's so much we don't know. And that is definitely applicable to non-native plants,
right,
or the native ours, native cultivars and things like that. So,
which we'll get into.
Yeah, we will.
Good segue. Might as well do it now.
Let's do it.
Well, what the heck is a nativar?
So yeah, nativar or a native cultivar. So, you know, there's lots of different plants that are cultivated that we've messed with, as I say, that we've, you know, tweaked a little bit.
What's a cultivar?
So, you know, a plant that we've changed for some reasons, we've selected it for something, you know, whether we want the flowers to be different colored or the leaves to be different colors or the plant itself to be more compact. So we have altered it a little bit for different reasons.
Right. And the key is that it has to be in order to keep those genetic or phenotypic characteristics, it has to be maintained asexually. So by cutting division, it has to be maintained, that genetic pool has to be maintained by man.
Whoa. Okay. What's a nativar?
So a nativar is a particular type of another group of plants called cultivars. And cultivars stand for, in the gardening world, for cultivated variety. These are plant varieties that can only exist on planet Earth if they are their genetic makeup is maintained by humans through asexual propagation. So if I take a tomato soup, echinacea, purple coneflower, and I let it just go to seed, it's not going to come back as that tomato soup variety with those nice red petals, for example. You have to maintain it through leaf cutting or division or some other means. So a nativar is just a native cultivated variety.
Aha!
Anyway, back to you, what you were saying about nativars.
Yeah. So, you know, how does that, like you said, how does that factor into pollination? How do those alterations that we're making impact the habitat resources for pollinators? And there's a big question mark there, you know? And I think it really takes a deeper dive to really look at those, if we're talking about pollinators, which we are, those pollen and nectar resources and how and if they are altered with when we alter those plants within those nativars. So, you know, sometimes if, you know, let's say the flower was made more compact, maybe the visual cue to the insect is different or missing, or maybe it's harder to access that pollen or nectar. So in some cases, those tweaks are not good. In other cases, they don't matter or there's no difference. So I'll give you an example. There's some research, I think in 2020 by Adam Baker. He was with Kentucky University at the time. Now he's with Davey Tree here in Ohio. But he was looking at milkweed, which, as we know, is the host plant for the monarch butterfly. He was looking at two natives. He looked at swamp milkweed, which is Asclepias incarnata, and then butterfly weed, which is tuberosa. And his question was, okay, we go to the nursery, we see all of these cultivars. Are they just as good for the monarch? If we're planting these butterfly gardens, can we use some of these native cultivars? And so he took a deep dive, right? He looked at what the nectar resources were for the monarch adults, and he looked at, will the females lay their eggs on the plants on these different cultivars? Do the caterpillars grow? When they eat those cultivars, do they you know, successfully go through that metamorphosis, chrysalis, birth, all that stuff? And the good news was, yes, that these three cultivars he looked at, and I can list them if you're interested. So for the swamp milkweed, it was Cinderella, Ice Ballet, and Soulmate. And for the butterfly weed or the tuberosa, it was Blonde, Bombshell, Gay Butterflies, and Hello Yellow. He found that all of those cultivars were just as good as a nectar and a pollen, or not pollen, excuse me, nectar and as a host plant. So that's good news, right? Yay! So we can feel good about putting out these cultivars knowing that they're going to be just as useful to the monarch butterfly.
That's the challenge, is the research.
Yes, that is the challenge, because we, like I said earlier, it's not black and white. We don't know. We have to take that deeper dive and go to the research and see if those resources are just as valuable. So there have been other studies that have looked at, so Ricker and others in 2019, they looked at native shrubs. And they found that some were great. Some of those nativars were good. Some of them were not. And it just depends on how that plant and those resources were altered. So that is the challenge, is getting the research. And I think that's happening more. At least at OSU, we have taken on a project where we're starting to look at some of those different nativars and how they are utilized and visited by pollinators. But not to tangent again, but that idea of visitation is something we have to watch out for. You really have to look at the nectar and the pollen and how they...
Yeah, just because they're going to it doesn't mean they're actually utilizing it.
Just because they're going... Yeah, so case in point, I'm going to back away from pollinators and go to birds. if we judged the quality of non-native invasive bush honeysuckle just by the visitation rate of birds eating the berries,
really successful.
Oh yeah. We would say that's one of the best plants out there because they just chow down on those berries. But we've taken a deeper dive and looked at those berries, right? We know that they're not as nutritious as our native plant berries. We know that because we took that deeper dive. So we have to be careful there.
For the homeowner, the one that to help put a finer point for the understanding of native ours, so echinacea, purple coneflower, or just coneflower since there's other that are non-purple, but that's probably where the most earliest nativar and the most extensive nativar breeding has occurred. They've altered this thing in all kinds of ways, especially, you know, pom-poms and da-da-da. So they've altered the physical structure of the plant, and the bee is not able to access, or pollen is non-existent.
Yeah.
Or the pollen is non-viable. And so you really looking at taking the time as you're putting your plant list, your shopping list together, and really looking at, and that's, so they're producing these things faster, way faster than any kind of research can follow up. So working with, not necessarily going with the newest and the brightest, but some nativars that are a little bit older, and again, where the research has been able to back it up is useful from my personal experience. The other issue with garden shops, they have to produce these plants that are pristine. There are no insect damage.
Oh yeah.
Right. So they are again using neonics, systemics, what that goes in with the watering, and the plant takes it up. So if an insect chews on it, they die. So you buy this thing. You plant it in your landscape. Now comes the insect that is, you know, coming to your, they chew on it, they die. So it's being very careful. And I don't really know if there's a way to kind of check on those kind of things, but I guess I'm bringing it up to help our audience become aware of the issues of what nursery industries are dealing with and what they're trying to do. And also, based on, so we can start shifting our demand and expectations, wanting that pristine plant that has no holes in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, all that kind of perception that we got to have the perfect fruit, the perfect whatever, when, because they know that's what's going to sell.
Right.
And so that will help maybe help the industry be able to then step back from some of these practices that are long term really going to screw everything over.
Right. Yeah, nature isn't perfect, right? We need to remember that. So we can't expect it to be perfect in our backyards as well, right? Especially if your intent is, you know, to attract pollinators and other wildlife species.
And welcome to the nerd section. That's right. It's the point in the show where we talk about the resources that we referenced in today's show, give you some direction on how to find those, and talk about some extras. First off, we'll start with the Monarch Right-of-Way Project, which is at OSU Mansfield. The link that we will provide will take you to the project's website, where you can learn more about the plots of native flowers that were planted on campus. Additionally, we provided a link to the Ohio Pollinator Habitat Initiative. It's a nonprofit and a collaborative effort of many agencies to raise awareness of the plight and importance of pollinators. We at Richland Soil and Water actually participate in this initiative by collecting and distributing free milkweed seeds, which are host plants for monarch butterflies. There is more info on that website as well. Our organizations are also good resources to learn about pollinators, don't you think, Josh?
Well, being a garden, oddly enough, there happens to be a wide variety of floral morphology to of which they can observe pollination partaking and occurring on a daily basis throughout the season. sometimes starting as early as February with the witch hazels blooming. Crazy, huh?
Yeah.
And all the way through to late October and November, depending on how late and warm things are at. So there's always something going on in the there's always something abuzz. Yeah, I know.
Well done.
Thank you.
Well
thank
done.
You. At Kingwood, no matter what time of year.
And as for Richland Soil and Water, like I said earlier, we participate in the milkweed seed collection and giveaway. We also host a native plant workshop and sale in the spring. We sell variety packs of native wildflower seeds and have native plant and pollinator information for you to explore on our website. Also, I want to make an announcement for you all. This episode has a part two. Our conversation with Marnie was so good that we had to make two episodes. But we are going to take a break. The next episode is going to focus on Richland Soil and Water Conservation District. As this past year, 2023, was our 75th anniversary, we were also awarded the District of the Year for 2023. So there's a lot to celebrate, a lot to talk through, including the development of a new five-year strategic plan, which we'll get into. I talked to our director, Erica Thomas, and we also will add in some interviews that were conducted with past board supervisors and staff. I think it'll be a really informative episode, and then we'll get right back to pollinator habitats. I also want to thank you for being patient for this episode. It's taken a long time to develop, and we're grateful for our audience, and hopefully you all know a little bit more about who we are, what we do, and what some of the other conservationists in Richland County are up to. Thanks again so much for listening.
That's it.
I feel bereft.
You feel bereft?
I don't know what to do with myself.